Okay, just give me the signal. Okay, good morning, everybody. And the shir today, which is the final in this three-part series, is L'Zecher Nishmas Rav Zev Shimshon Ben Yaakov Tovia Halevi, Zichrono Livracha. We hope that the Divrei Torah and all of the learning that all of you do and should be Le'ilei Nishmaso. And thank you for the family for sponsoring this. I want to talk a little bit about Hanukkah. The truth is, although it's a little, it's a tiny bit early, not too much. I already see the neros and the oil is being sold, and the like. And also, since this is our last year, and I myself am going to Chutz La'aretz for 2 weeks, so it's worthwhile to talk about this a little bit. But I'm also going to connect it to what we talked about last week about suffering and evil in the world, because certainly one of the most powerful ideas of Hanukkah is the hisgabrus ha'or al ha'choshech, the ability of even a little bit of light to overpower darkness. And that's a very, very important idea. But first let me start with this. In Parshas Bereishis we have a pasuk. Ha'aretz ha'isa sayhu v'avayu v'choshech al p'nei sahayim. The world was tayu, astonishingly empty, v'avayu, a state of jumbled confusion. That itself is contradiction, which shows you how confused things were. V'choshech, and there was darkness, al p'nei tahom, on the face of the deep. The Medrash Rabbah says that this is a remez to the four exiles that the Jewish people will undergo. And that is tayu, astonishing emptiness, is Malchus Bavel that was machriv the Beis HaMikdash and took the divine presence out of this world, making the world empty. Vayu, confusion, is a remez to the gullus of Persia. That was a very short gullus, actually. You know, Persian took over from Babylonia, but the one outstanding event in the gullus of Paras was Haman, who tried to destroy the Jewish people. And when Haman made his gezeira about destroying a whole nation, the pasuk says, "Ho'ir Shushan Nevocha." The city of Shushan was confused. So bayu, confusion, is paras. Choshech, darkness, is malchus yavan, that darkened the eyes of the Jewish people with all of their gezeros against the Torah. And al p'nei tahom, on the face of the depth, is the malchus of Rome, because that malchus is a malchus that seemingly never ends. The Babylonian gullus was 70 years. The Persian rule was only around 52 years. Yavon was a few hundred years. Edom, although there's no Roman Empire, but we are still in the gullus of Edom, the gullus of Esav. And that has lasted thousands of years. We don't know when it's going to end. We hope every single day, but we don't know. And that's tahom. It's like you drop a penny down a deep, deep well, and you don't even hear when it hits the bottom. It just keeps on going. The Maral explains that the very fact that at the very beginning of creation, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is merames, the four exiles, show us that it is inherent in a physical creation that there are imperfections, and those imperfections require a process of refinement till eventually there can be Kedusha in the world. The world could not be created perfect, because by definition, when something is Gashmi Chomer, a word the Maral uses quite a lot, it is Chomer Ha'ochor, it is a dark material separation from God, and there are imperfections that need to be worked out through the laborious process of Golos that takes thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And that is why in Maaseh Bereishis itself, there is a remez to the four exiles. But the Maral goes further. And the Maral says, each exile has a unique characteristic. And this refers to the enmity that is shown towards Am Yisrael. The gullus of Babel is a gullus of slavery and persecution. That's what Nebuchadnezzar did. Nebuchadnezzar essentially destroyed our autonomy, took away our independence, enslaved us, subjugated us. See, Paras and Yavan didn't have to do that because we already were enslaved from Babel. We never got out of Babel, so to speak. So the enslaver is Babel. Paras represents the gullus of genocide. Haman was obviously the ancient Hitler. He didn't care if you were from or not from. Physically, destroy Am Yisrael. What is Yavan? So Yavan is very interesting, and this is why Yavan is called darkness. Yavan is the gullus of assimilation. See, contrary to what we might think, we sometimes look at Antiochus as the vicious anti-Semite who just wanted to kill Jews. Not at all. A Chiloni person might actually call Antiochus, with some sense, a great civil libertarian. Because after all, Antiochus was not an anti-Semite. Antiochus was perfectly willing to give Jews 100% of political, social, civil rights as long as they stop being different. Just be like everybody else. Forget about the bris milah that makes the body separate. Forget about Shabbos that sanctifies your time. Be like everybody else. It is only when the Chashmonaim refused that Antiochus resorted to war. But his initial strategy was not war. His initial strategy was assimilation and Hellenism. And in point of fact, most of the Jews accepted that. So it's very interesting. Paras was the traditional Hitler, Nazi, anti-Semite, we're going to kill Jews because we hate Jews. Yavan is actually the gullus of assimilation and friendship. It turned into war because we rejected that friendship, or at least the Chashmonaim did. And indeed, Yaakov Avinu prays when he says, Hatzileni na, miyad ochi miyad Esav, save me from my brother, from Esav. The Beis Levi asks, that's redundant. Esav is his brother. The answer is, Yaakov is afraid of two things. Yaakov is afraid of the Esav that'll kill him. And Yaakov is even more afraid of the Esav that says, be my brother, be my friend. Because the Esav that wants to kill me, the danger is to my guf. But the Esav that wants to befriend me, the danger is to my neshama. And therefore, the gullus of Paras is the gullus of genocide of the guf. The gullus of Yavan is the gullus of assimilation, adopting values. Now, this is a very, very scary thing. We don't even realize how all of us are conditioned by the secularism and decadence of Western culture. You know, we think, you know, we're Shomer Mitzvahs, Baruch Hashem, etc. The problem of assimilation is the other people who intermarry and don't keep Shabbos, although, of course, even on that level, the other people are our brothers and sisters that we have to care about. But the truth is, even us. Rav Shimshon Afal Hirsch once said about the 19th century Orthodox Jew that we are the opposite of the Muranos of Spain. The Muranos of Spain had to behave like Goyim on the outside, and they remain Jews on the inside. We, Baruch Hashem, have the total freedom to be Jews on the outside. But what is our panemius? What is it that we care about? Do we look at mitzvos as 613 problems you have to get around in order to do what's really important in life? Or do we look at mitzvos and avodas Hashem as what our life really is? You see, there are different ways one can... Within a person who's a shomer mitzvah, there are different types of hashgafas. There is kind of an idea, my life is about my job, my career, my amusements, whatever it might be, but nebuch, I got this thing called Shabbos, I got this thing called kashrus, and I'm going to be faithful. And by the way, that's a madrega too. I don't want to disparage that. That is a madrega. That person is worthy of respect. But the attitude is, I look at the mitzvos as something that I got to get rid of in order to do what I really care about. That's the gullus of Yavan. That's Yavan. Okay, so the Maharal has identified Bavel, Paras Yavan. What is gullus Edom? We're in gullus Edom. So the Maharal says, gullus Edom, and I'm paraphrasing obviously, is kind of like Japan. What does Japan do? Japan never creates anything new, but they take all of the good ideas of every other country and they can develop it to a more intensive way. Edom is a combination of Bavel, Paras, and Yavan intensified and prolonged for thousands and thousands of years. So if you look at the history of Galus Edom, you will have the Bavel Shebi Edom, where Jews are subjugated and persecuted and enslaved. You will have the Paras Shebi Edom, the Holocaust, genocide. And you will have the Yavan Shebi Edom, assimilation. In point of fact, although unfortunately there are still places where Jews are physically persecuted, there's no question we have to pray, but at least in Western countries, and I include Eretz Yisrael as a Western country in that sense, the gullus of Edom that we face, you could call the Yavan Shebi Edom. The nisyonos we have in our lives are Baruch Hashem, well, I was going to say, they're not physical issues of security, although we do have them, and I guess in Eretz Yisrael especially, we're conscious of it. But the day-to-day struggles that we face are not struggles of our physical security, but they are struggles about our value system. So that is why, even though you might say, gee, why am I making such a big deal about the gullus of Yavan when we're in the gullus of Edom, which is a different gullus? The answer is, Edom has no meaning other than being connected to the other three gullias. And the issue that we're facing in our lives is the nature of the gullus of Yavan, the gullus of Yavan. Lubavitcher Rebbe used to say, it was easier to be from in Siberia than suburbia. And that's a very true statement, because in Siberia, you have to be Jewish whether you liked it or not. So, you might as well be from, at least this is going back many years before the communists kind of eradicated things. In suburbia, a person doesn't have to be from, doesn't even have to be Jewish. You know? And if one is Jewish, it takes a great deal of strength, a great deal of mesiras nefesh, etc. So, Siberia might be the gullus of Paras and Bavel. But suburbia, whether it's, you know, Scarsdale or Ramat Beit Shemesh, suburbia, whatever it might be, the Nisayon is Yavan. Now, Baruch Hashem, as they say, in Eretz Yisrael, we're zocha to a great, great deal of Shmira. Certainly, one cannot compare apples. It would be apples. It wouldn't just be apples and oranges. It would be, you know, apples and something totally different. Apples and dresses or whatever it would be to compare Eretz Yisrael to Chutz Laretz. But still, we still face those Nisayonos, even in the environments that we are in. Okay. Now, I want to share with you a thought about this idea of Choshech. Yaakov Avinu is coming back this week from being away from Eretz Yisrael for actually more than 30 years. 14 years in the yeshiva of Shem V'Ever, 20 years in Lavan's house, 34 years. He's coming back. And he gets news that Esav still has enmity in his heart, and Esav wants to kill him. So what happens under these circumstances is that Yaakov is very frightened. He is afraid. Although Hashem gave him a divine promise, Yaakov is afraid, Shema Yigram Achet, maybe his sins make him undeserving of Hashem's protection. So the night before he meets Esav, in the flesh, he meets the guardian angel of Esav. And they wrestle, and they struggle. And there are times that the angel wins and is on top of Yaakov. And then there are times that Yaakov turns over and Yaakov is on top of the angel. And this is a long struggle that lasts for a long night. And the Sefer HaChinuch says, this is Hashem's remesh to Yaakov that there's going to be a gullus. And the gullus is going to be bitter and the gullus is going to be harsh. But at the end of the gullus, there's going to come a beautiful morning. And at the end of that morning, we're not going to come out totally healthy. We'll come out limping. We will be limping. Am Yisrael, Hashem is telling Yaakov, we'll suffer in this gullus. But at the end of that time, even the enemy that tried to destroy us will give us a blessing. And therefore, the Mefarshim all say that the whole Rebbe, Sefer HaChinuch especially, is Marech in this, that the whole struggle with Yaakov and the angel is a foreshadowing of the gullus that will culminate in the aura of Mashiach. But at the end of this story, after the angel blesses Yaakov, Yaakov asks the angel, tell me your name. And the angel says, Lama zeh tishal lishmi. Why are you asking me my name? And the angel left. Rashi explains that the angel is actually saying, I don't have a fixed name. My name depends on my job. Every day I have a different job. Every day I have a different name. Therefore, I can't tell you my name. But there's a pshat in the name of Reb Leib Chassman, who is a great, great Baal Musar and Mashgiach, that says that the angel is actually giving Yaakov his name. My name is, quotation, don't ask my name. That is my name. My name is, don't ask my name. Perhaps I shouldn't mention this, but you don't have to acknowledge it if you're embarrassed, but some of you might be familiar with the very famous Abbott and Costello routine. Who's on first? Again, you don't have to. I'll embarrass myself. And that is, who's on first? Where the joke basically is, the name of the player is who. So one person asks, who's on first? He's like, who's on first? That's what I'm asking you, right, etc. So the idea is, what's your name? Don't ask my name. I want to know your name. Don't ask my name. That's my name. My name is don't ask my name. What type of name, Rav Chassman says, is don't ask my name? You're going to name your child no name? So Rav Chassman says the following beautiful words. And he starts off with a mashal. A farmer, a non-Jewish farmer, a Polish peasant, once came to the big city during market day. And he had never heard of a motion picture or a movie. He was not aware of it. And he was told that if he buys a ticket and he sits in a dark room, he will see animals and people come out of the wall as if it is magic. So he didn't understand. So he buys the ticket, he sits in a dark room, and all of a sudden, the wall gets lit up, and animals, people, like horses, I guess they used to like to watch westerns in Poland, my mother tells me, that they would come out of the walls. And he couldn't believe it, because when he walked in, the wall looked solid. So how did they get in? Is there a hidden door? So he took out his nice, powerful flashlight that he also bought that day. And he shines it on the wall to see if there's a hidden entrance. But of course, when you shine a bright light in a dark room on a screen, you lose the picture. The picture disappears. So people yelled at him, and they said, shut off the light. We can't see the picture when the light is on. Reb Chassman says, this is actually a mashal for Olam Hazeh. When we live in darkness, we don't think about life. We just go with the flow. We go on automatic pilot. We sleepwalk. All sorts of things look real, which aren't really significant. Whether it's the money, the power, the grudges we have with people, the various, you know, slights that we nurture in our heart for so long. And it becomes so important to us. But if you turn on the lights, two things happen. That which is not real disappears. And then that which is real, you can see. You know, you could have had, you're sitting in a dark movie theater, whatever it is, you might have, you know, $10 million next to you. But when it's dark, you don't see it. So darkness, even in a physical way, does two things. It makes you see things that aren't really there. And it disables you from seeing the things that are really there. And if that is true for physical darkness and physical light, it is also true in a spiritual sense. That when I live in darkness, and remember, Yavan is called darkness, what happens is I don't see what is real. And I see things that aren't real as if they're significant. So Reb Leib Chassman says, when Yaakov Avinu asks the angel, tell me your name, he understands that this angel, as the guardian angel of Esav, is also symbolic of the Yetzer Hara that brings evil into the world, that makes people, that's Moshech people, to do Averos. A name represents the power of something. When you name a child, the Arizal says that although parents might think we're naming our child after a particular relative, in reality, the name we give a child is a prophetic revelation from the Almighty as to the nature of that child's neshama. Now, we don't understand that exactly because we're not familiar with the root of neshamas. But a child that is Avraham, there is something in the kayach of his neshama that is rooted all the way back into Avraham Avinu. Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, Esther, Sarah, Devorah, whatever it would be. Again, we're not bucky enough to know what that shorish is. But that's a prophecy HaKadosh Baruch Hu put into the parents. That's why the Moshe of Chaim Kanevsky, others, is not in favor of newly created names. Sometimes in Israel we get new names. A new name is not connected necessarily to a neshama, etc. I'll just tell you this little joke. It's not such a great joke. It's a little funny, but I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. And again, Shira is a very, very beautiful name, and it's a totally appropriate name. But Rav Chaim Kanevsky doesn't even like Shira because Shira is not in Tanakh as a name. So when somebody said he named his daughter Shira because it was Shabbos Shira when she was born, so he said, are you going to name your next daughter Parah if she's born during Parshas Parah? Again, I apologize. Again, she was a beautiful name. But, don't worry about it. Just a little joke that he made. Okay. But be it as it may, a name represents the spiritual power that is within a person. That is why it's brought down in some Sfarim that even if the name at a bris was given by mistake, if Hashem caused that name to come out. I was at a bris once where the one that was honored with naming the baby was a grandfather. And the grandfather didn't like the name that his daughter chose. So when it was time for Kriyas Hashem, he just changed it, I think, to his father or something like that. And I still remember from hearing from the Ezra Snachim, a little bit of a scream there. And the Rosh Hashiva that was there actually paskens that May Hashem Yatsa Hadabar, this is the Ratzon Hashem, and this is the child's name, etc. What's interesting is, though, a week later, I think about this a lot, because a week later, I was at a bris with the same Rosh Hashiva, and here, the person that was Koresh Shem didn't hear correctly. In other words, so they whispered a name to him, and he didn't hear it, and he said the wrong name. And the Rosh Hashiva said, there, it was a mistake, he didn't hear the name. So now maybe it's a difference between a grandfather who has more of a koach to name and somebody else. Maybe there's a difference between an intentional deviation, which is a real naming, versus a mistake. I'm not sure. All I have is I have these two stories with a contradiction in outcome, and you can kind of try to figure out exactly what the difference is. So when Yaakov asks the angel of Esav, what is your name? Yaakov is asking the angel, what is your power over people? And Yaakov is simply raising the following problem. Why do people do Averis at all? It just makes no sense. How do you get people to do Averis? Because whatever inconvenience a mitzvah might involve is so infinitesimally small compared to the reward you're going to get. And whatever little pleasure I get from an Avera is so nothing compared to the ownership. Why, from a purely rational perspective, how do you get people to be Nichshol B'Avera? What is your name? What is your trick? What is your power? What is your koach? The angel's answer is, my koach is, people don't bother to get to know who I am. They don't know my name. Meaning, we're in the dark. When we're in the dark, we think things are so real. I'm sure all of us have had this experience where something seems so big to me. You know, somebody insulted me and I'm like so angry. A person has anger sometimes. And the thing that you're angry about seems to be so big, so important, that you can't move on. And even if you're a tzaddik and you don't express the anger, let's say, but it just eats you up and eats you up and eats you up. But then, if you're zochet to come to a different place, you kind of look back and say, What on earth was that about? Why did that make a difference? That's when the lights go on. When you're in the dark, the illusion becomes a reality. When it's really nothing at all. Right? So that's the idea of Choshech. So when we call the Golas of Yavan Choshech, it really is, we could say, not just the Golas of assimilation, but it's the Golas of illusion. It's the Golas of being taken in. Now, it's especially difficult, though, because there are good things about the Golas of Yavan. Remember, the ancestor of Yavan is, of course, Yefes. Yefes is the third son of Noach. And Noach gave Yefes a bracha. Yaft Elokim liYefes. Hashem gives beauty to Yefes. The Yishkain bi'ahalei Shem. And he shall dwell. Shem is a Hebrew word, not an English word. He shall dwell in the tents of Shem. Shem, of course, is the ancestor of the Jewish people. And Yefes, via Yavan, was blessed with an extraordinary appreciation of all the aspects of beauty, of the physical beauty of the body, that has a point as well, the beauty of art, the logical beauty of mathematics and science, the rigor of philosophy, all of these, although they're intellectual pursuits, they're connected to beauty, to symmetry, to the logical elegance of things coming together. Yefes and Yavan were given that bracha. And that's a good thing. But as Rav Hirsch points out, when is the wisdom of Yavan beautiful? When it dwells, when it's subordinated to the belief in Hashem, which is the Ohel Hashem. So the Chachma of Yavan has a makom in the world when it is subordinated to the idea of Emunah and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But when you take it out as a separate entity, which is Moreid against Hashem, in which the human being becomes the highest goal, right? The human being becomes their own God, so to speak, their own Avodah Zarah, the glorification of the Ani, then it becomes destructive. So that makes the struggle with Yavan especially difficult. Because you know what they say? They say that what they call food addictions are the most difficult addictions to break, because you cannot go cold turkey, forgive the pun, on them. Because you got to eat. So if a person has a reaction where as soon as they eat, you know, their body goes crazy, what are you going to do? You got to eat. So an addiction where you do participate in it is much more difficult in some ways than an addiction that you can simply go off. I mean, it's hard to go off that too, but if a person has an addiction to heroin and they go cold turkey, it'll be very, very difficult for a while, but at some point they can beat it. Right? So our addiction with Chachmas Yavanis is like a food addiction. Because on one hand, we can't escape it. And indeed, we're not supposed to escape it. Chachma Bagayim Tamen. We use telephones. We use technology, hopefully in good ways. The Rambam writes that even art is something that can bring a person to a great appreciation of Hashem. Mathematics, Chachma. But, like anything else, if it's not for Yishkin B'Ol Hashem, it's very, very dangerous. And that's why it is a Choshech, because it distorts our perception. And like the Polish peasant sitting in the movie theater, when you're in the dark, all the things that don't really count seem real, and you don't see the reality of what you have. Which is very interesting. According to this explanation, the real problem with Golas Yavan is not the persecutions of Antiochus. The real problem was the voluntary assimilation of all the Jews who didn't have to be persecuted by Antiochus. Antiochus' persecutions were only a relatively small amount of time. Golas Yavan is around 200 years. Antiochus' persecutions are 20 years. So 180 years of Golas Yavan, starting with Alexander of Macedonia, there were no coercions against the Jews. Jews just assimilated, like America or whatever it could be. That's really what Golas Yavan is about. Let me just mention another thought about that encounter. Chavitz Chaim raised the question, Why do we find only Yaakov encounters an angel that wants to destroy him? Why doesn't Avraham have a similar type of struggle? Avraham had other struggles. What about Yitzchak? Some malach, some the Yetzer Hara that wants to destroy him. So the Chafetz Chaim used to say, it's Yadua, Pirkei Avos, that the world stands on three pillars, Torah, Avoda, Gemilas Chasadim, Avoda is Korbanos, Tefillah. And it's also Yadua that each of the Avos represents one of those pillars. Avram's Avoda is, or Avram's Amida is the Amida of Chesed, and Yitzchak, who was a Korban, is the Amida of Avoda. And Yaakov, who spent 14 years in the yeshiva of Shem V'Ever, represents the Koach of Limud HaTorah. Now certainly, of course, Avram learned plenty Torah and did Avoda, and Yitzchak, everybody did all three, that's to be sure, but each one excelled. Each one's unique Koach was in one of those things. To be a Jew, you need all three, for sure. Right? Indeed, a Ben Torah that's not Osek in Chesed, there's something wrong with that. Care about other people, love, worry about them. But although you need all three, and without all three, one cannot be a real Yid, Torah is the most important of the three for the following reason. From a proper learning of Torah, you will be able to move to Chesed and Tefillah. But the other two will not automatically bring you to Torah. So this is what the Chafetz Chaim says. The Chafetz Chaim says, the Yetzer Hara is a very shrewd investor. The Yetzer Hara is perfectly willing to let Jews do mitzvahs as long as the Yetzer Hara is convinced that in the short term they're going to fail and it will not continue to the next generation. So Avram is Chesed. So the Yetzer Hara says, let Jews do Chesed. Let them do tzedaka. Let them build social welfare institutions. Let them build kupat cholim. Let them build hospitals. Fine, let them do mitzvahs because I know it's not going to last to the next generation. When it comes to avoda, let them have their shuls. It'll last 20, 30, 40 years. Yetzer Hara, let Avram do his thing. Let Yitzchak do his thing. But Yaakov, who represents Torah, the Yetzer Hara has to destroy that. Because through Torah, there is going to be intergenerational continuity. And that the Yetzer Hara must stop. Now, the Chafetz Chaim was not talking about the history of the United States. But those of you that are familiar with the American history understand that these words are absolutely very, very accurate. There have been Jews in the United States, you know, since the 1600s. You know, they've been there a long time. But the first major wave of Jews to the United States occurs basically in the last decades of the 19th century. And their primary emphasis was social welfare institutions, fraternal lodges, many hospitals, many of the famous Jewish hospitals were built in those days, taking care of our brethren, Chesed. And the products of that generation are basically totally assimilated, almost totally disappeared. The next great wave, around World War I, was the wave of the great, great, beautiful synagogues. I don't know if you know, they don't build shuls like this anymore. I remember shuls in my youth that were still around. Beautiful stained glass edifices. Magnificent, huge buildings. Those were the days when you had to buy a ticket for the high holidays. And they actually had people, you know, checking you for your tickets. And we had even rules where if you went to the bathroom, be sure to take your ticket with you. All of these, like you're going to a theater or whatever it is, and the like. And these were magnificent shuls, houses of God. And if you go to any inner city, in a major American city, you will still see these magnificent buildings with the Hebrew of the Aseres HaDibros still in the stained glass windows and a crucifix on top. That's why they stopped building shuls like that, because we know in the Gala, it's not going to last. Unfortunately, Bavonoseinu Harabim, even in Eretz Yisrael, sometimes our shuls don't last, Gush Katif and everything else, and Bezer Hashem, that should certainly stop. But the point basically is, what happened to that generation? All lost. There were Yechidei Skula, people like Irving Bunim, Zecher Tzadik, people like that, who managed somehow to remain Shomrei Shabbos, Shomrei Mitzvahs. But overwhelmingly, that is called the lost generation, overwhelmingly, people left the Torah, people left Yiddishkeit, and through intermarriage and the like, almost totally gone. The third wave is after World War II. Now again, I'm simplifying because there were some yeshivas in America before World War II, but basically the immigrants who came here after World War II, they primarily tried to build up mostos of Torah, whether it's the day school system of Torah Amsora, whether it's the many yeshivas gedolos, kolalim that exist. And it is only when institutions of Torah learning were created that there was what you could call significant, not enough, but significant intergenerational continuity. Because it is, and that's what the Chafetz Chaim is saying. Let the Yidden do chesed, let the Yidden do avodah, it's not going to last, so I don't care. Let them do mitzvahs in the short term, it's not going to last. But to have Torah learning, that I'm going to stop. And the Chafetz Chaim says, that is why the sorrow shel Esav attacks Yaakov and does not attack Avram and Yitzchak. Again, I want to emphasize, obviously when I say Torah learning is the most important, chas v'shalom, I mean, even a person in yeshiva needs to be Isaac in Aveda Shebelev and in Gemilas Chesed, and sometimes indeed in the yeshiva world there may be a short changing of those very, very important things. And indeed, one of the ways that a woman helps her husband is to remind him of the importance of those things. But it's equally true that Torah is the fuel and the energy that enables all of those other endeavors. One final point, and I want to move over to a different aspect of Hanukkah. That is, the Chafetz Chaim makes another point. So, what does the angel of Esav want to do? Destroy Torah. But the angel doesn't do it! And that represents the idea that there will always be Jews learning Torah. But the angel has a partial victory. The angel smites Yaakov on the thigh, and Yaakov is limping. What is the thigh? So the Chafetz Chaim quotes the Zohar HaKadosh that says, just as the thigh supports the body, so those who support Torah financially and emotionally are the thigh. So the angel of Esav could not destroy Torah learning, but the angel of Esav had a partial victory that the support of Torah in the world will always be precarious, meaning the thigh will be weak. Ad kedei kach, the Chafetz Chaim used to say, if there is any Torah institution that does not have financial problems, one must question how authentic a Torah institution it is, because the sorrow shel Esav had a, that's why I think the Midi Ladi, I think it's a Baruch Hashem, a good Torah institution, and that is, the idea is, that the sorrow shel Esav achieved this idea, that the thigh of Torah is always going to be limping, is always going to be weak. Now you might say, so next time a yeshiva comes to me for money, I might say, sorry, you're supposed to suffer. Well, that doesn't work. Next time a woman gets pregnant and she wants anesthesia, say, sorry, Chava is supposed to suffer. And in fact, that actually was a 19th century argument of Christian theologians. When anesthesia was introduced to help women in childbirth, some Christian theologians, all of whom were men, said, women are not allowed to take any painkillers, because it was the curse given to Chava, b'esev tel dibonim. What is our response? Our response is, Hashem said that this is the nature of the world. The nature of the world is that childbirth is painful. The nature of the world is Torah will struggle. But we are still commanded to do our mitzvah. Right? We have a mitzvah to alleviate pain, and we have a mitzvah to support tzedakah. So one can never use, otherwise one wouldn't go to the doctor. If there's, God forbid, sickness, right? What do Christian scientists say? God made you sick, so what are you trying to do to change it? we say exactly the opposite. For Rapo Yirape. Everything comes from Hashem, but Hashem requires us to do that Hishtadlus. Right? You know the story about, it's not so funny anymore after Katrina and the like, about the righteous person who was caught in a flash flood, and the water was getting higher and higher and higher. So he climbed to the second story, to the attic, and the helicopters came by with ladders. He said, I don't need you. Hashem helps me. And the boats came by. I don't need you. Hashem helps me. And the airplanes come. And he keeps on turning down every avenue of help because he says, I believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I don't need Basar V'dam. Unfortunately, all of the avenues were exhausted. And in his last moments, he calls out to Hashem. He says, Hashem, why have you abandoned me? And Hashem answers. He says, I tried to save you 5 times. You know, you kept on saying no. That's how Hashem works. Hashem works, usually, b'derech hishtadlus. We have to work. We have to go to a doctor. So just because it's the teva shebedavor that hachzakas Torah is going to be difficult, that doesn't absolve us of our responsibility to do what we can. It's the same with sickness, same with childbirth. I mean, that's a common idea. We don't consider a klala or a impediment to be a destiny that one cannot work on changing. Okay. So that's a little bit of a reflection about the gullus of Yavan and the like. And of course, it's very, very cruel in some ways that, in a sense, the whole story of Hanukkah, which is the story about the courageous Hashmonaim defeating Yavan to establish a kingdom of Torah, that the Hashmonaim in the course of time became the very enemy they tried to destroy. The so-called Hasmonean dynasty was started by great, great tzaddikim. The Hashmonaim were great, great tzaddikei elyon, the Ramban says. Now the Ramban does say it was an avera for them to become kings because kingship should belong to Yehuda. And after they won the war, they should have found a descendant of Malchus based of it. There was an avera there, but certainly the first generation of the Maccabees were tzaddikim whose kavanah was totally l'shem shemayim. And yet, the Hasmonean dynasty lasted for around 150 years till it was conquered by Rome. And the cruel paradox is that the later Hasmonean rulers, the Hashmonaim, became the very enemy they tried to destroy. They became Hellenists. They became persecutors of the Chachamim. Yanai HaMelech, we read about in the Gemara. Alexander Yanai went by Greek names. These were people who were just as bad as Antiochus. They were killing the Chachamim and the like. So, in a way, this is why Chazal, in the course of time, actually de-emphasized the military aspects of Hanukkah. Because from the perspective of history, the nitzachon of the milchama was significant because it enabled a reestablishment of Torah. But if it turned out that that's not what happened, then in a sense, the Hasmonean dynasty is just a continuation of the Yavanim. And that's why you'll notice in the Al-Hanisim, it's a famous question. The Al-Hanisim, which was written very, very early, is primarily about the milchama against the Yavanim. But when the Gemara discusses Hanukkah, it emphasizes the miracle of the oil because the milchama was no longer considered to be that significant. There was actually a change in the meaning of what you were celebrating in the course of time, because what use is a political victory, a military victory, if spiritually you're in the same place you were before that victory? And it's even worse because now it's a Jewish Hellenist instead of a Goyish Hellenist. Right? So the Hasmonean dynasty was a very tragic dynasty in many, many ways because it began with so much promise and it ended with so much kilkel and the like. And that's why if you read the whole Talmud, you will see there is very little. This is a 200-year period. I mean, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel lived during this time. I mean, the great rabbis of the Mishnah lived during this time. And they almost never refer to it. It's almost as if they just ignored it. Because as far as they were concerned, it was the same as having a foreign Geisha king. It was no better. mean, it's very notable that such a period that really very, you know, from a historian perspective, it's an important period of Jewish history, and the great rabbis who lived through it don't pay any attention to it whatsoever. Now, I want to go back a little bit. Yesterday's Parsha, or 2 days ago's Parsha, we read about Yaakov Avinu when he's going to Chutz La'aretz. And Vayifka Vamakom, he encounters the place. And the sun sets all of a sudden. And Yaakov prays to Hashem. And the Gemara says from the word Pigia, which means encounter, that Yaakov Avinu enacted the custom that we have to daven Maariv, Shmona Esrei. Well, not the Nusach, but a prayer, some type of prayer to Hashem at night. Avram enacted the prayer of Shachris, not the Nusach, not the text, but the idea of praying to Hashem. Yitzchak enacted the prayer of Mincha, and Yaakov enacted the prayer of Arvis. Now, there's another halacha that says, the Rambam tells us, that although Shachris and Mincha are obligatory prayers, Maariv was originally an optional prayer, and only later it became an obligation because people accepted it as a minhag. That is why most women, even if they daven twice a day, which the Mishnah Berurah says they should, although again, there are different heterim when you have children and the like, most women, generally, again, there may be many exceptions, do not daven Maariv, because even for men, Maariv is an optional prayer, except because they accepted it as a minhag, and women, it is said, did not accept Maariv as a minhag. So Rav Tzadok asks a very simple question. How do you reconcile these two contradictory ideas? On one hand, Avraham Shachris, Yitzchak Mincha, Yaakov Maariv. But then you say, Shachris Mincha obligation, Maariv optional. Why should the prayer of Yaakov Avinu be inferior to the prayer of Avraham and Yitzchak? If Avraham and Yitzchak's prayer is a chovah, why should Yaakov's prayer not be a chovah? After all, in many ways, Yaakov is considered to be the choicest of all the avos, right? Avraham had a defect which came out in Yishmael, and Yitzchak had a pagam that came out in Esav. It's only Yaakov that all of his children are the shvatim. They had their problems too, Mechiras Yosef, but still, they have Kedushas Yisrael. And on the Kisei HaKavod of Hashem, the Gemara tells us, Hashem has the image of Yaakov Avinu with him at all times. So why would Yaakov's prayer be subordinated? Why would it be inferior to Yitzchak, Avram and Yitzchak's prayer? So Rav Tzadok says a very beautiful thought that I think is a meaningful thought in our own tefillas. Now, we live in the world of artificial light, so Shachris, Mincha, Maariv, it's all the same, you know, we're all the same artificial light, same Shmona Esrei. But if we were more attuned to the world of nature, we would understand that each prayer is designed to elicit a unique emotional response within us. Shachris, Mincha, Maariv may be the same words of Shmona Esrei, but the emotional connection to God is different each time. Shachris, which ideally should be davened when the sun comes up, right? That's Pasikin, exactly with the rise of the sun. Shachris is the prayer of hope, optimism, and gratitude. It is a joyous prayer. I know some people are not morning people, but generally speaking, one wakes up in the morning, one has a sense of hope that even if the preceding day was a difficult day, there is, as you hear the birds singing as if they were welcoming you, there is a sense, maybe today is going to be different. Even in halacha, it's brought down, you should not visit a seriously ill person the first 3 hours of the day, because he will look so good, you may not pray for him. He doesn't need my prayer, he looks great. Don't visit him the last 3 hours of the day, he'll look so bad, you'll give up, no hope. Visit him in the middle, where he looks bad, but not so bad, and as a result, you'll be mispalo for him in that way. So Shachris, the prayer of joy, gratitude. Rav Tzadok says, this prayer is makushar to Avraham Avinu. because Avraham Avinu's life saw the realization of so many of the divine blessings. He was zocha to live in Eretz Yisrael. He was zocha to have a child at the age of 100 with Sarah, who was 90 years old. Even the bad son Yishmael, after Sarah died, Rashi says, Yishmael and Hagar came back and did tshuva. Yes, Sarah died, but she was not a youngster, 127. They had a long life together. Avram was respected. He was honored. He was admired. Nisi Elokim Atavasochenu. And Avram's impact on the Canaanite populations was profound. He and Sarah, according to some Midrashim, actually made a majority of the population Maminim in Hashem. That puts Or Sameach and Eshet Torah combined to a great deal of shame in terms of those statistics and the like. So Avraham Avinu, after he passes the ten Nisyonos, is a person who sees the light of Hashem, the chesed of Hashem, the goodness of Hashem, the kindness of Hashem. And therefore Avraham is connected to the morning prayer. What's mincha? Mincha, although you can daven mincha half an hour after noon, but the ideal amount of mincha is before sunset, right? Before sunset, but while the sun is setting. So you have the sun is already low in the trees, and you have the lengthening shadows of the evening. It's day, but you still have it, but you see that night is coming. If shachris is the prayer of gratitude, joy, serenity, optimism, yet mincha is the prayer of panic. When a person still has the brachas, but you feel they're slipping away into darkness. Please, Hashem, let me hold this on a little bit more. Even in terms of zmanim, mincha is a panic prayer, actually. Because, you know, again, Baruch Hashem, in Eretz Yisrael, not so bad. If you have to daven in the street, middle of the street, you know, you can do it. If you have to, you know, and there's always a shul nearby anyway, but, you know, even, you know, whatever it is. I see countless seminary girls always davening mincha and Malcha Yisrael streets and the like. But, you know, but if you're in the United States and you're in a working environment, mincha in the winter is, you know, where am I going to daven mincha? Where am I going to find a place to daven mincha? You know, some of you might remember the phone booths. You haven't seen them recently. But if you would be in Penn Station 20 years ago in a January winter afternoon, you would see all 20 phone booths occupied by Orthodox people who were trying to, of course, since they were in Chutz La'aretz, it was a long-distance call, but they were trying to make a long-distance call to connect to the Almighty, as it were. So mincha is about panic. Things aren't so secure anymore. I still have Hashem's brachos, but I'm worried. I'm scared. Rav Tzadok says, that's Yitzchak. Yitzchak lived in Eretz Yisrael, to be sure. In fact, Yitzchak is the only one of the Avos who never left Eretz Yisrael. But remember, the 400 years of exile begin with the birth of Yitzchak. Now, how is that so? Yitzchak was not in exile. Yitzchak was not a slave. But the answer is, Yitzchak was made to feel a stranger, even in his own land. Petty harassment. The wells that he digs, the Pelishtim come along and fill up, kind of saying, you know, your father, maybe, did a lot of good stuff here, but who are you? Think about, to take a Chutz La'aretz analogy, think about how the Jews might have felt in Germany in 1932, or the beginning of 33. Hitler got elected chancellor, 1933, but there were no Gezeres yet. There was no Kristallnacht yet. There was no loss of business. But you're walking in the street and you get the distinct feeling you're not really wanted here. You know, get out of here. Yitzchak was getting that vibe in Eretz Yisrael itself. So you understand that Shachris is the prayer of serenity and gratitude. Mincha is the prayer of panic and fear. What is Ma'ariv? When Yaakov is running away, Yaakov is not a young man. Yaakov is 63 years old, according to the chronology that Rashi gives us. He has no wife. He obviously has no children. Eliphaz ben Esav stripped him bare, so he's totally poor. He is leaving the holiness of Eretz Yisrael. He is leaving his father, thinking he will never see his father again, although Yitzchak lived many more years than Yaakov thought, but Yaakov clearly thought Yitzchak was going to die. Yitzchak never sees Rivka again. And one should also recognize that Yaakov is deathly afraid of the spiritual catastrophe of living with a man like Laban. He's really going from the frying pan to the fire, because he knows he has to leave because Esav wants to destroy him. But he's going to Laban, who is dishonest and immoral and an Oved Avodah Zarah. And Yaakov has a Mayra Dika Pachat, that his whole destiny, his whole future, to be an Am Hashem, is going to be destroyed. So Yaakov, at this point in his life, now of course, Yaakov does have the beautiful dream of the ladder, but remember, that's after he prayed. When Yaakov prays, and by the way, just to add to it, the sun goes down and plunges him in total darkness. Because that's exactly Yaakov's life at this point. Penniless, friendless, hopeless, plunged in darkness. He's not even the Yitzchak that still has everything, but he feels it slipping away. Yaakov has hit bottom. And b'derech hateva, there's no Yeshua. So Rav Tzadok says, if Shachris is the prayer of gratitude, and Mincha is the prayer of panic, Mayriv is the prayer of Emuna. Emuna is the ability to feel the love of Hashem. Even when everything is hopeless, you're in Auschwitz, you're in a concentration camp, to understand Hashem's love. And Hashem responded, but that's only after Yaakov prayed. And that is why in the Birchas Kriya Shema of the morning, we say Emes V'Yatziv, God's Emes is firm and established. And in Kriya Shema of the night, Emes V'Emunah, God's truth, I believe in, I don't see it. This is a word that many Sforim say, I'm sure you've heard it before, Lahagid Baboker Chastecha. David HaMelech says, in Tehillim Tzadik Beis, 92, Mizmor Shir L'Yom HaShabbos, I declare your kindness in the morning. That means in life, there are morning times of M-O-R-N-I-N-G. There are times of light and brightness. And then I declare your Chesed Hashem. But what do I do when life is dark? I don't feel the Chesed. I don't see the Chesed. I'm groping. I don't see a way out. V'yemunascha b'alelos. I have faith, even in darkness. So this is what Rav Tzadok says. I started off with a question. Why should the prayer of Mayriv be optional? Rav Tzadok says the following. In order to make something a chova, it has to be an obligation that every single person is capable of, from the time you're bar mitzvah or bas mitzvah. The prayer of gratitude, although we're deficient in that too, is so elementary that everybody can be expected to be grateful for the Chasdei Hashem. The Navi Yeshayahu says, Yad Ashor Kaneo, even the ox knows the hand that feeds it. The chamor and the donkey, Avos Ba'alav. Not to be grateful, this is why Jews are called Yehudim. Leah called her fourth son Yehuda, because she said, Hapam, now I am grateful to Hashem, Oides Hashem, because she knew she's entitled to three sons, because there are four wives and 12 shvatim. But when she has a fourth son, she got more than her chelek. The Sfas Emes says, every Jew is called a Yehudi, because I have to feel in my life, Natalti, Yeser, Al Chelki. Hashem has given me more than I deserve. So gratitude, of course. Panic? Well, that's the old saying. There are no atheists in foxholes. Even the atheist, when he's really in trouble, turns to Hashem just in case. So the prayer of Avram and Yitzchak are so basically understood, they become a chovah. But Rav Tzadok says, Arvit is a much higher madrega. It's the madrega of seeing and feeling the presence of Hashem in the total darkness of life. To see and perceive not only the light at the end of the tunnel, but to see the light in the tunnel itself. So Rav Tzadok Tainis, the optionality of Ma'ariv, if there's such a word, does not stem from its inferiority, but it stems from the idea that it represents a madrega to which we must work towards. But it's not something that will automatically come to us. Meaning, chova is like the basic things that every person is expected. But that level of amuna is a deeper level, a higher level. We work towards it as an aspiration, but it cannot be concretized as a chova. The connection to Hanukkah is a very, very significant connection. You know, people often think that when we regained custody of the Beis HaMikdash, the Yavanim had the Beis HaMikdash for 3 years. They contaminated it. They desecrated it. They sacrificed pigs to Avodah Zarah on the Mizbeach. They built houses of prostitution in the Beis HaMikdash itself. Interestingly enough, they gained control of the Mikdash on the 25th of Kislev. 25th of Kislev. 3 years later to the day, on the 25th of Kislev. That's the Hanukkah. The Hashmonaim were able to regain. So it's literally, the day of the desecration was the same day as the day of the liberation and the redemption. But people think, we found the oil, it burned for 8 days. People think that was the end of the war. That was not the end of the war. The war with the Yavanim went on for more than 20 years. But I think if you understand the Neros as the beginning of the struggle rather than the end, there's something very beautiful and very powerful about Hashem's message. Because let's imagine you're a Maccabee or a Hashmonaim, and you're looking at a prolonged military struggle with the greatest power in the world. You have so few people, so few resources, and you don't even have the support of your own nation. Most Jews looked at the Maccabees as ultra-Orthodox fanatics. And you can apply this to a number of contemporary situations. They looked at them as people who were making things hard for the rest of the Jews, and people who were so primitive, they were going, I want to go back to the Middle Ages, that's an anachronism, but you know, you're going back to whatever it is, you know, the ancient times. We got to be modern and progressive here. Be a modern first century Jew. You know, whatever it would be. And you can understand, what if the Hashmonaim just said, you know, there's no use doing this. If we want to keep the mitzvahs, we can run away to the mountains, we can hide into the caves, and we'll do our mitzvahs, but we can't change this world. This world is too big. It's too powerful. The odds are overwhelming. What's the use of even trying? What does Hashem show them at the beginning of their struggle? Here you have a little bit of oil. B'derech HaTeva, it can only burn for 1 day. So you might figure, what's the use of lighting it? What's the use of lighting the menorah on Monday if we'll be out of oil on Tuesday? Let's just wait for a week till we get new oil. But what does Hanukkah say? You do what you can. And then Hashem takes over. What are the Hashmonaim hearing? See, people like to say Hanukkah has two miracles. There's a miracle of the war and the miracle of the oil. But I want to suggest to you that the miracle of the oil and the miracle of the war combine. Hashem gave us the miracle of the oil so that we would get the courage to keep on going. We look at life in so many ways, and this applies nationally and also in our own lives. So much darkness, depression, family issues, shalom bias, issues with our children, sickness in our families. And we sometimes just think, what can I do to make things better? It's like, you know, I remember, you know, Washington, D.C. or Silver Spring doesn't have a lot of snow, but once in a while we get really big blizzards and we get paralyzed. We're not like Chicago that can handle it. Even if we have 1 inch of snow, things get shut down. But a few years ago, we had something like 10 inches of snow, which is very, very unusual. So you couldn't drive, you couldn't do anything. But I remember walking by somebody's house, actually your neighbor, walking by someone's house, and their elderly mother-in-law, very, very fine, righteous woman, she wanted to help clear the driveway for her son-in-law, who was trying to drive. So she took a dustpan, trying to get rid of the snow. Now, a dustpan, now to get rid of 10 inches of snow, is something like using a thimble to empty out the ocean. And sometimes we look at that and say, what's the use of my doing anything here? It's just a thimble in the ocean. What does Hanukkah say? When you're surrounded with darkness, do what you can. You think it's not going to help? Do what you can. And then Hashem takes over. But if you don't do what you can, then Hashem doesn't take over. If they wouldn't have lit one day of oil, there wouldn't have been any miracle of the oil. The miracle of the oil was conditional on our lighting that oil. And that's what the Chashmonaim are hearing. Don't give up. It makes no sense. It seems like, you know, you can't do anything. Do what you can. You know, they tell the story. It must be a modern story because it uses a modern technology, but it sounds like an old story. They tell the story about a king who constructed a tower that was 1,000 stories tall and said, anybody who can climb to the top of the tower by the end of the day gets to marry my daughter. In these stories, the daughter is never consulted. So nobody even bothered. 1,000 stories. How do you climb 1,000 stories? I don't know how many stories was the World Trade Center, 100 and whatever it was, less than 200 stories. But a guy said, I'm going to try. So he climbs up 10 stories, 15 stories, out of breath, you know. But people are laughing at him. You know, what's the big deal there? 15 stories, 985 to go. He goes, 20, 30, getting harder and harder. But again, it makes no sense. At the 50th story, he collapses in exhaustion. But the 50th story turns into an express elevator landing that takes him all the way to the top. He had to work to exhaustion to do something that mitzad atzma was worthless. But at that point, the Kadosh Baruch Hu takes over. This is what Chanukah is. Chanukah is such a beautiful Yom Tov, precisely because it basically says that we have the capacity to do what we can to light the darkness. And then Hashem blesses our efforts beyond what we thought possible. And darkness exists on so many levels. The darkness of assimilation, the darkness of ignorance, and the darkness of depression and despair and loneliness. All of this is darkness. And what is our job in life? Our tafkid in life is to be people who try to create light. And even if the light we create seems to be small and insignificant and meaningless, the message of Chanukah is, if you do what you can, Hashem will turn it into an Or Gadol. So I wish you all a Freilich Chanukah, good Chanukah, and together for Sukkot.